The first noble truth, which we talked about last week, but just to summarize it for those of you that weren't there, basically the Buddha is saying that the way the human mind is set up is to cause stress and suffering for itself. It's the Buddha said, in life, the way we are set up to live it, the way we are, the mind is born, and the way we're trained, the way we are just propelled into this world, we are trained and set up to suffer and to get stressed out. And it's a pretty remarkable just first foundation, A, because a lot of people just don't like looking at stress and suffering. They want to build a spiritual path on the exact opposite, like we can offer you happiness, which the Buddha's teachings do offer. But he starts out by saying, in order to learn anything, in order to accomplish anything spiritually, we have to do what we don't like to do, which is look at our own stress and our own suffering. And the first thing he said about it is that it's the way the mind is set up. It causes itself a lot of stress, a lot of suffering, and it's not really, unlike the way we think, it's not caused by the world. It's actually the way our mind is set up. We like to blame the world for the fact that we're stressed out. We feel a sense of lack. We feel different or unhappy or unique or there's something wrong. But that's just the way the mind is set up. The mind's proclivity to take everything personally, to wrap it all up in a story about me, to build narratives and to look for a theme and to plug it all into this is all happening to me, creates this illusion that there's something very personal about the fact that we're suffering or we're stressed out. We really believe that there's, oh, I'm stressed out, there's something wrong. And far from that meaning that there's something wrong, that means that we just happen to have a human mind. It's like when we go to the doctor, as Ajahn Brahm says, we go to the doctor and we say, doctor, there's something wrong, I'm sick. And Ajahn Brahm often points out, well, actually you got thousands of different parts of your body that are all interconnected. And if any one thing goes wrong, your blood pressure, your blood sugar levels, the amount of hormones, anything, the enzymes, you're going to get sick. It's a miracle that we're ever healthy one day of our lives. We should go to the doctor and say, doctor, there's something wrong. I'm healthy. There's nothing wrong with me. All these intricate little parts are working perfectly and I'm doing all right. That's abnormal. But there's nothing abnormal about the fact that we are stressed, that we're depressed, that we're suffering, that we're anxious, that we think there's something wrong with our lives, that we think that there is something that should be better, that should be different. Actually, and we tend to look around and we tend to find those one or two schmucks that look always happy. They're generally on TV. If they're not, then they're a yoga teacher that we know. Or, you know, those yoga teachers, oh, I'm so glad you came. I find it difficult to go to yoga just because of that unbelievably phony New Ageism stuff. With the exception of my... You would never get that.
What you see is what you get.
Yeah, you just say, fuck you, welcome, come in here. So there is no such thing as people who are just born completely naturally happy. It's not, and the Buddha never taught that there was a Buddha nature within. That is something that people... Many years after added, hopefully, hoping that if, you know, you would just buy some crystals or buy their book, that somehow magically, by listening to what they taught, that all of a sudden this magical happiness within you would just flourish. The Buddha never taught that. The Buddha said that all of our lasting happiness is cultivated by effort. The mind is not naturally created or programmed to be happy. The mind, when you look at it, if you unpack it, is actually all of its resources are going to the fear parts of it, the stress parts. The limbic system has the vast monopoly on all the dopamine and all the hormones. We are set up to freak out. And the fact that we don't freak out more often or aren't more depressed more often is a testimony often to how good we are at denial. We very often aren't aware of how stressed out we are. Sometimes we come home and then we might all of a sudden realize that our shoulders are up to here and we're not aware of it. Our entire body is tense. Our throat is tight. Our chest is like a rock. Our stomach is, we're often not aware of just how much ambient stress. And the Buddha, in his writings about the First Noble Truth, writes and points at something that's very similar to what the existentialists and the post-structuralists call this sort of existential despair. He says at one point, not only is stress and suffering, aging, sickness, death, the sorrow and lamentation of losing people, but he talks about a despair about life itself, and a sense of not getting what we want. And he says there are those of us that are born and we are subject to aging, illness, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, all the things of life, and we wish this were not the case. We wish life were otherwise than it is. And then he goes on to say, but wishing will not make it so. And this creates more stress. This is where he's pointing us directly towards the Second Noble Truth. Like all the thinkers of his time, the Buddha believed that this suffering, the stress that we were experiencing, was not something that was just completely a given, that we had to, simply because the mind is set up, that we have to suffer for the rest of our lives. He was very optimistic. He believed that the vast bulk of our unnecessary stress and suffering was caused by something that we do. And just like the thinkers of his time, the Jains and the Hindu practitioners of his time, he believed that somehow the cause of our suffering was in our craving, our wanting life to be other than it is. The fact that everybody gets sick, everybody dies, everybody experiences loss and not getting what they want, and everybody has sorrow and lamentation and despair, but each of us takes it personally and believes, oh my God, this is happening to me. And therefore we deny it and we look for a way to push it away and make it all go away. So we drink or we eat or we get obsessed with our careers or we get obsessed with a relationship or we get obsessed with just fixing that one thing in our life where we believe that we could just get rid of that one thing in our life, everything would be better, and we would finally get to be happy. And that's not the way it works. The Buddha said it's that craving for things outside of the mind to try to fix us that creates so much of our suffering. So much of our unnecessary suffering is looking in the wrong direction for our happiness. It's looking and attaching to things that cannot bring us lasting peace of mind or calmness or tranquility. Now, the Buddha didn't say that there wasn't a way to achieve those things. He, in fact, said there is a way to achieve lasting happiness and peace of mind. It's just that we always are looking in the wrong direction. So this is a very optimistic, not pessimistic teaching. But the first thing he's saying is rather than take it all personally, rather than believe that there's something wrong, understand first that this is the nature of the mind and that any happiness you're going to develop is going to have to be cultivated, and it's going to be cultivated from within. Not by attaching to things outside of your control. Most of us try to attach to again, things outside of our control for our happiness. And that's not unusual. From the moment we're infants in our cribs, when we feel alone or scared or hungry or fearful, we cry out and we wait for someone to give us reassurance or food or nourishment or a sense of being okay. So we're used to looking to the world to make us get rid of this internal feeling of insecurity. And the problem is that this internal feeling of insecurity cannot be satiated by the external world. The Buddha taught, in fact, that some things happen when we start getting things from the outside world. We develop, in essence, very similar to addiction, we develop a tolerance. You've heard stories of people who make $1 million in the stock market, and they say, well, the first million was exciting, but then after that I had to make $1 billion. Because making another million no longer fills them up, no longer satisfies them. They need to make more and more and more money. And still, at the end of the day, they don't feel fulfilled or enriched. They're trying to take something out there and answer a pre-existing sense of there's something wrong, there's something incomplete about me, there's something different, there's some missing part in the head. And you can't take things out there and fill that feeling of lack in here, that sense of despair, that sense that there's something missing. So it has to come from within. Now, the Buddha was different from the teachers of his time, where even though they were aware that craving was involved, they never really developed a very advanced teaching of how exactly craving worked and how the causation of our suffering worked. And the Buddha went much further than the other teachers of this time. He suggested a couple of things. The first thing is he said that everything we experience has generally, especially our suffering, has a cause. And this cause, in the case of our suffering, is craving. He also said that craving or the causes of what we're experiencing can be immediate or they can happen over time. That's very important. They can be immediate. Sometimes the things that we do have an immediate effect. And sometimes the things we do have a delayed effect. I'll give you two examples. A delayed effect is, suppose you have a neighborhood and suddenly there's massive unemployment in that neighborhood. Over a period of time, not immediately, but over several months or years, the crime rate will go up because people will have not as much access to jobs or income, and eventually we see statistically that when people lose their jobs, eventually they start resorting to crime to survive. So that's not an immediate cause and effect. That's one that happens over time. On the other hand, there are certain causes and effects that are immediate. For example, if I said everybody in the left side of this room, my right, is dressed awfully spiffy tonight, then immediately everybody on this side is going to think, hey, what about us? The moment I focus on, I say, everybody here looks great tonight, everybody here starts thinking, hey, wait a second, what's that asshole trying to say? The moment I start saying that this piece of the paper, side of the paper, is good, I immediately create bad. So sometimes a cause and effect happen immediately. I'll give you an example of how that works in our own life. There are some times when we wake up and we're on the wrong side of the bed and everything we notice is shitty and we hate life and we hate everybody around us and we hate our jobs and we hate our friends and we hate everybody in the street and everybody in the subway looks ugly and is in our way and we really don't want to be anywhere. We just want to crawl back in bed. And then suddenly we might practice a sense, suddenly out of the blue, we might remember something or have a sense of gratitude for something that we did, or somebody might say something nice to us that completely changes the way we perceive the world. And suddenly, it's like night and day. Sometimes just by changing our intention, we can immediately affect our stress. Simply by changing our expectations. When we wake up and we're in a bad mood, it's often because our expectations are such that we want life to be different. And then when somebody says something positive or we remember something positive, then we don't want life to be any different anymore. We realize that life isn't as bad as we thought it would. And that simple change can change the way we perceive everything. It can have a huge sweeping difference on what's going on. So sometimes the things we do have immediate effect, and sometimes the things we do have delayed effect. The important thing about this is to no longer experience when we're stressed out, or when we're anxious, or when we're upset with someone, or when we're freaked out, or when we're in an obsessive state. We no longer experience it as something that's just happening to us by accident. We no longer have to experience it as something that we're powerless over. Oh, my mind just freaks out. Sometimes I get obsessive. Sometimes I just start worrying about the economy. Sometimes I just start worrying about what's going to happen to me. Sometimes I just start worrying about what people think about me. All these thoughts that we attach to immediately cause what the Buddha called papancha, stress, suffering, lots of thought. And so when we think about the stuff and we attach to it, over time the mind fills up with thought. And when the mind fills up with thought, the Buddha said, that is suffering, that is stress. So what we can do is we can see, oh my God, I'm just really worked up right now. My body's uncomfortable, or I'm just anxious, or I'm repeating activities that I know are bad for me, like I'm sitting in front of the computer, eating two pints of ice cream, and jerking off to porn, and whatever we do, right? And we see that, and we're like, oh my God, this is not just happening. This is the result of something that I have attached to, some thought, some intention I've had earlier. So this gives us an ability to like then look and say, okay, what have I been attaching to? What thoughts have I been focusing on, fixating on? What stories about myself have I been telling? What could I change, experiment in changing? And we can start experimenting and seeing what the results are. This is what a whole strain of Buddhism known as kamatana is, which is viewing our experience as this play of changing one thing and one thought and seeing what the results are. So sometimes if we're just obsessed about a relationship, the Buddha said, well, look at what you're focusing your awareness on. And see if you can refocus your awareness on something else. And see if that causes stress or suffering. See if the mind gets filled up. I'll give you one example that I always use. When I'm in an interaction with somebody that goes poorly, afterwards, I'll notice that if my brain fills up with self-justification, well, that asshole is such a jerk, I was right to blah, 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 blah. The moment my mind fills up with self-justification, I know there's stress there. And I know then the simple thing to do would simply be to call up and make an amends or just undo it. Because even though that takes effort to make an amends or apologize or change it, the good news is that that effort will be repaid by emptying my mind of all that stress, that thought, that self-justification. On the other hand, if I choose to do the easy thing, which is not call them up, my mind stays filled up with self-justification. What I learned from this, and what the Buddha taught many, many times throughout the suttas, is that unfortunately for us, very often the easiest thing to do in life causes the most long-term suffering. And sometimes the thing that's the hardest to do in the short term causes great relief and calmness and tranquility for us in the long term. Meditation is a great idea. It is boring. It is boring. It is boring sitting watching your breath a lot of the time. Sure, after you've developed it for a while, it's wonderful and it's relaxing. But at first, for the first 7 or 10 years, I hated it. I started doing it when I was a kid. When I was a kid, my dad dragged me to hear Zen Buddhist talk when I was 12 years old. And I hated every moment of it. And my dad got us cushions. And I was sitting when I was a kid. And I hated it. And I hated sitting when I was in my 20s. And I really hated it well into my 30s. And but, you know, it's now probably the one thing that keeps me sane. My sanity is not given to me. Believe me. You in my head, you know that. I have to work, scratch and claw, tooth and nail, just to keep, you know, to keep above the waterline of sanity, folks. It's the result of effort. It's the result of effort. And all of the things that are easy, in the long term, I found out, generally don't bring me a lot of long-term peace of mind. A lot of things are very easy. Sure, I can, you know, turn on the TV and zone out like the rest of the world. I can certainly get lost in daydreaming when I'm trying to meditate. I can certainly get caught up in listening to people gossip about other people rather than, say, you know, actually we're straying into an area that is going to just cause me mental agitation. I can't listen anymore. All of that stuff requires effort. But in the long term, putting the effort in at the beginning gets paid off. I'll give you some examples of things that always pay off. And then I'm going to talk a little bit briefly about the difference between craving and desire. And then we'll save the Eightfold Path for next week and how that can be practiced. Well, first I'll talk about the difference between craving and desire, because it's a question that always comes up. There's nothing wrong with having goals. I personally have a goal right now, which is after Dharma Punks tonight and we all talk, I'm going to walk across the street to Whole Foods and I'm going to go to the brownie case and I'm going to buy a brownie. And however, if there is no brownie in there, my mind will not fill up afterwards with all these invectives about the fucking world and the yuppies that eat my brownie. I can say this because I have filled my mind up with such dialogues about the yuppies that have eaten my brownies when there are times in my life when I carry around stress that I haven't stopped and look at, and I always have to check in with my body to make sure that I'm not carrying around stress that I'm aware of. But when I forget and stress builds up, then when I go and my brownie isn't there, it's fuck you. Like, fuck you, Adam, you ate my fucking brownie. I know you fucking did, you brownie eater, right? But so that's what happens. We don't realize that there's stress already there, underlying it. And we attach to something in the world, the lack of a brownie, and we blame the lack of a brownie. If only there was a lack of a brownie, I wouldn't feel this miserable. No, the stress is already there. The suffering is already there. That's what the Buddha is saying. It's already there. And it's already there because we're not looking, seeing it, putting the effort into relaxing the body, putting the effort into calming ourselves, putting in the effort to letting go of our attachments and bringing our effort back into our spiritual practice. So the difference between craving and desire is wanting something, but if we don't get it, it's fine. We let it go. It just passes away. We don't leave scratch and claw marks into, like we do sometimes with relationships. No, no, no. Or when people we don't like are around, we want to just push them away. that's craving. It's when we just don't let things go. Either we push them away or we cling. And we especially do it not physically, but in our minds. When we are craving, there's a mental aftertaste to the events of our lives. We don't move on to the next thing. We're still living in the past after something is happening. We're still living in that meeting at work and that person who doesn't listen to us, or the boss who doesn't understand or is impossible, or the friend who calls us up and only talks about themselves and doesn't listen to us. Once we get off the phone, we're still in that conversation. That is clinging. When we bring something that's past into the present, mentally. So that's how you know when you are clinging as opposed to desiring something. You can desire to have a great career, but if something happens and you just have an average one, and you wind up living in all this sorrow and self-grieving and lamentation and feeling victimized, that's suffering. On the other hand, if you're like, well, you know, I got to do this, I might not be the greatest whatever, but I'm still making a living at it, or I'm doing something else, that is letting go. That is not craving. So that's the difference. Now, the other thing is if craving causes suffering, then the state of nibbana, or enlightenment as the Buddha was saying, or just unbinding from our suffering, feeling calmness, is none other than the state of not having craving. When we let go of craving, then we are as close as we will ever come to that pure state of freedom. So the Buddha said there's two ways you can go about it. And we're going to go into detail next week of how you go about it. But there's two ways. You can either let go of whatever it is we're craving. Now, most people just find just letting go of something they're obsessed about very difficult. So fortunately for us, the Buddha said, actually, there are certain kinds of craving that are okay. Rather than simply letting go of craving, you can actually just take that craving energy and direct it at something that is skillful. And he said in the Four Bases of Power, for example, that craving tranquility and calmness is perfectly reasonable. And a more effective way of going about it, for example, is developing kindness. Kindness for ourselves, understanding that there's nothing really unique about the fact that we're stressed out and suffering. It's just the way the mind is set up, and that it takes a lot of effort to change that. There's nothing personal about it. There's nothing that's being done to us. Being very kind, being compassionate, viewing ourselves and the beings around us that are suffering as beings that deserve to be happy, and being willing to be gentle with ourselves and understanding with ourselves, rather than believing that if we're having financial problems that it's our fault and we have to beat ourselves up into shape and we have to just live in the fact that we are financially insecure. That is not kind or compassionate. That is being rough with ourselves. A good example of being compassionate is, of course, lots of people are financially insecure right now. Why shouldn't I be? Right? I'll just do the best I can. I'll take the actions that I can. But living in this dire result in my head of imagined homelessness, where I'll be wandering the street one step ahead of gangs that will be trying to kill me, which is where my mind often goes unless I'm diligent, right, is not helpful. Not helpful. Another state that is always, always skillful is appreciating. Appreciating the skillful things we've done. If you're ever stressed out or obsessive or living in remorse or just wondering what to do next, a great place to start, rather than getting caught in the ping-ponging of trying to figure out how to live your life and all the possible outcomes, is simply reflect first on how skillful things you've done. Appreciate that, and that will remind you that no matter what choice you're about to make in your life, happiness will be possible, no matter what you decide. Happiness is always available because it comes from within. So those are some things to ponder. I'm going to go next week fully into a much more detailed version of the Eightfold Path, but I thank you for listening to the second and third Noble Truth tonight. And now it's your turn to share anything that's going on or ask any questions.